I'm Stephen Abraki, and I'm conducting an exclusive interview with Carolyn Yu. Carolyn is an international authority in coaching, training, communications, writing, public relations, and marketing. Carolyn, you just have a fantastic background, and thank you for sharing some of your experiences with our audience.
Oh, that's my pleasure, Stephen. Thank you.
Carolyn, you've done so much in so many different areas and as an international world leader. So what are some of the milestones and lessons that led to your current roles?
I guess it's been a bit of a journey. I began my career as a journalist and a newsreader in radio, and then moved out of, after just a few years, into technology marketing. And that's kind of been a mainstay of my career since then. So public relations and communications consultant in the technology space, and I love this sector. You know, I've worked with some of the biggest names in the industry, ranging from Microsoft and Compaq and Hewlett-Packard and Fujitsu to PeopleSoft and Siebel, and, you know, both on the hardware and software side of the things. And also, you know, I've done a lot of work over the years with professional associations in the tech space, and that's been a real theme throughout my tech career. But I guess, you know, it's the personal journey that always drives the professional journey. So, you know, there's been moments in my life that have been key turning points. I've been freelance since I was pregnant with my daughter, so that happened in 92, and so then I built a career as a consultant and a freelancer. But then when my marriage ended in 1996, I really went on this journey of personal growth. You know, did 2 years of counselling, started reading books, and then did quite intensive personal development programs with people like Tony Robbins, John DeMartini, you know, Steve Linder. And through that, sort of learned about coaching and some of the skills involved in coaching, such as neuro-linguistic programming, and hypnotherapy and timeline and things like that. And so developed those skills and moved into coaching and the leadership space. So, yeah, it's been an amazing, 30 years of my career thus far, I guess, and still lots to do, lots of opportunities moving forward as well.
Well, again, just a fantastic background in all the different areas. I know you're really, really busy and heavily scheduled because of the high demand of your elite expertise. What are, I guess I'm trying to drill at is, how are they being expressed in your current roles, and what are your current roles?
So I divide my time between, I have my marketing communications and public relations business in the tech space. So I really only work with a few organizations in that space, and they're mostly long-term clients, or clients that are very much grouped around the area of professionalism, professional associations. So I work both with the Australian Computer Society here in Australia, which is the professional association, and I also work with IFAP, the International Federation for Information Processing, which is where I met you, and that is the global professional association for those working in the tech space. So it's been great to sort of take my 20-plus years of experience with the ACS and then expand that into the global arena, because it's very much the same key messaging and the same issues that we're dealing with, but on a global space. So that's the PR side of things. And then over the last 13 years, I've developed my roles as a coach, a leadership trainer and facilitator, an executive assessor. So working with business leaders, senior executives, C-level executives, assessing their capabilities, assessing their strengths and their areas and opportunities for development, and working with them to build their leadership, enhance their ability to lead and inspire and develop their teams and grow leaders within their organisations and achieve their goals. So I'm very passionate about that space of human potential and helping people and organisations to achieve their potential. So those are two key areas that I'm involved in.
Well, you know, we're going to, again, drill deeper and mine some of that expertise. And if you can provide some tips in each of these areas of expertise, and if you can think of one, perhaps a short case study or an example is illustrating the points. So I'm going to ask you a series of questions on different areas of your background. And that's where I'd like, you know, some tips or maybe even a short case study or an example. So first of all, let's start with executive coaching.
Sure. So as an executive coach, and I work with business owners and senior execs, I've got a number of clients in the IT industry, but also across government, consulting firms, and small business. And part of my role is to assess the clients in terms of their values, their attitudes and behaviours, and I use a range of profiling tools to assess that, to assess their values, their cognitive skills and so forth. And that provides me with deep insights that open the door to powerful coaching conversations. So, yes, I teach various tools and strategies to enhance leadership. And a big focus of mine is the ability to engage in the accountability conversations with their teams. You know, if I'm to, say, to look at, say, the GFC of the late 90s and early noughties, you know, it's like the biggest issue, in my opinion, that contributed to that, and if you see the movie The Big Short, which was fantastic, you'll get a deep insight, it was the lack of accountability. Organisations and individuals were just doing whatever they wanted, and there was no accountability. There was no one saying, well, hang on a sec, that's not ethical, there's no integrity here, or that's not true. And so they just got away with it. And that caused, you know, those problems in the subprime mortgage lending and so forth. So it's about being able to have those conversations and hold people accountable and challenge what isn't true. So my job as a coach is to create a safe space for my clients to explore their issues, their challenges, to help them find the solutions and strategies to their problems. And as a coach, you know, what we do more than anything else is ask questions. You know, I hold up the mirror. I kind of go, this is what I'm seeing. And what do you want to do about it? It's not for me to set the agenda. That's very much the domain of my client. Where do you want to go? What do you want to create? Great. Now that I know that, I've got the tools and strategies to help them get there. I'll challenge their thinking, their assumptions. I'll hold them to account. And my job, you know, it's my job to say the things that others won't say, to really sometimes get in their face and go, hang on a sec, you just said this. So that's not consistent with that. And how do we move forward and really be willing to have the really confronting the honest conversations that their staff won't say or their boss doesn't know how to say. Now, and when we have a challenge, you know, when I'm working with my clients and they're in a problem, and often when they're in a problem, all you see is the boundaries of the problem. One of my trainers has a great tool that he does in his training. He'll get out a big garbage bag, you know, one of those big plastic bags, and he'll carry it around, and he'll talk about it as, this is my problem, this is my challenge. And we do that sometimes when we have a challenge. We'll go, oh, yeah, this is my problem, and we'll get a lot of recognition or significance for our challenge, and it makes us feel important and special. But often the challenge is getting in the way. So what my trainer, Steve, will do is he'll take that garbage bag and he'll blow it up like a balloon, and then he'll stick the ends of it in his pocket that will have the balloon sticking out in front of him. And he'll walk around the room, if you can imagine this, with this big garbage bag sticking out in front of him like a balloon, and it's knocking people in the face as he's walking towards them. And so sometimes we use a problem as something to keep other people at a distance, to stop that intimacy that might happen otherwise, and to stop people from really getting close to us and then seeing the truth. And then my trainer will then take the bag and he'll open it up and kind of put it over his head and completely cover his upper body with it. So he's actually in the problem. And when we've got a major challenge, that's what it feels like. I'm in the bag, and all I can see when I'm in the bag is the boundaries of the bag, and I'm surrounded by it, and it's black and it's dark, and I'm really constrained when I'm in the bag or in the problem. And that's what it feels like when we're in a problem. We actually become stressed, less resourceful, and less able to solve the problem. And, of course, the solution to the problem is not in the bag. It's outside the bag. And so when we're in the bag and all we can see is the inside of the bag, we can't see the solution. So my job as the coach is to poke a hole in the bag through questions, through challenges, and to actually encourage my client to kind of poke that hole. They've got to do it, not me. And to say, look, hang on a sec, let's look through this. Let's look at things a different way. And once they poke the hole and can see that there's something outside, then to actually pull the bag apart and step out of the bag, because there's always more than one solution. There's always a way to solve a problem, but sometimes we've got to be willing to change our perspective or to take a different tack and to actually step back out of the problem to really see what the solution is. So if I was to offer tips to managers and leaders wanting to coach their staff, I'd say use questions to make them think. Often it's tempting when someone comes to you with a problem, just, you know, if you know the solution or you know what's going to be a quick solution, say, oh, yeah, just do this. But that doesn't teach them to think. And it was Henry Ford who said, the hardest thing in the world is to get people to think. Because it's true, we want to be lazy. We tend to be lazy and we tend to go with the path of least resistance. And so finding a new path, finding a solution that we haven't come to before, that can require some hard work. So if one of your staff members or your team comes to you with a question, rather than just fixing it and creating dependence on you, push back and go, okay, well, what do you think needs to happen? And, okay, go away and think about it and come back to me with three recommendations or three possibilities and tell me which one you recommend. And then once they've done some thinking about it, then absolutely sit down and give them feedback on their ideas and their recommendations, help them to refine their thinking, but get them to do the work first. Another tip is also be willing to let them fail. We learn much more from our failures than we could ever learn from our successes. And good leaders, you know, they'll let their people free, set them free to actually try and give them some space, some autonomy to actually take on the challenge and try new initiatives. And yes, you know, it may not always work, but often it will. If you support them and give them the right encouragement and support, then yes, you know, and they'll learn enormous amounts in the process.
You know, that's fascinating. Some really good tips there and lessons and a lot of experience coming to play. How about applying, you know, these kinds of ideas to executive training then? What are some of your tips and lessons in that area?
Sure. So when I'm working in executive training, I tend to work with executive teams. So that means the whole executive, which might be 7 to 10 people, is in the room together and we're working, you know, through a leadership program perhaps. And so in that context, we'll have monthly trainings and then also monthly coaching to ground the learnings. So what I've learned along the way is, you know, I talked before about the challenge of accountability and how that has allowed some really difficult situations to develop around the world. So the first thing I teach an executive team is how to hold people accountable. And I teach a couple of simple strategies. I'll back it up and I'll give them some context around, you know, what different communication styles and the impacts of those. And we'll look at things like passive communication, aggressive communication and passive-aggressive communication. And then we look at assertive communication, which is obviously the preferred communication style. And I'll give them specific tools and strategies to enable them to communicate in an assertive way. And then we set up a bit of a game. And we set like a month or two where it's like, okay, now that you all know how to use this strategy, then this is, you know, this is a game you're going to play, and we put rules around the game. And so for the next month or two, whenever they see something that they go, oh, well, that's not working, or that person's not taking responsibility or acting with integrity or doing what they said they would do, then they are empowered to challenge that person. And we create safety around that because we, you know, they have rules or specific ways that they're allowed to respond when someone is communicating assertively with them. So we make it very safe for that to happen, to really encourage those interactions. And once everyone in the team has learned that process and is actively engaged in it, you see things move really quickly. Things that have been problematic for months and perhaps years get cleaned up all of a sudden because now someone's willing to challenge and has the tools and the capability to challenge something that they may have seen before but gone, well, I don't know how to fix that. I don't know what to do, and hey, it's not my responsibility. So there's a big focus on taking responsibility, really living, you know, sort of above the line as opposed to in integrity as opposed to below the line where we play the victim, and really owning, you know, the fact that I have to take ownership of what I can do and then encourage my colleagues in the team to similarly take ownership of what they can do. And together as a team, we work together and being really clear on the vision and the mission and the values of the organisation and where we're going, what our purpose is and our goals, and then working together as an executive team to really drive those outcomes over a period of time.
And then continuing in this sort of series, what are some of the lessons as a business growth strategist?
Sure. So if I was to pick one key thing as a business growth strategist, then having the right culture is absolutely critical in an organisation. So, and that affects everything you do within it. It affects how you communicate. It affects how you drive goals, how you support people within the organisation, and making sure, in fact, that the people you bring into the organisation are a good fit, because that can be a really negative thing. If you bring in someone who's not a good fit culturally, they'll actually drag down the culture and tone of the organisation. You know, in the recruiting space, I've worked and continue to work supporting recruiting processes with assessment tools and profiling tools to ensure that my clients can check in on the attitudes and values of people they're hoping to bring into an organisation. Because historically, you know, we hire for skills and we want to make sure we've got the right skills match, and the IT industry is, you know, really famous for this, that they want an exact skills match. But we tend to fire for attitude. You know, if someone's got all the skills, great, but wow, they really didn't do the work, or they really didn't own it, or they were problematic or communicated in a negative way. And we don't fire them for not having the skills. We fire them for not fitting in and for being a poor cultural fit. So we need to establish up front whether they're going to be a good member of the team and really be able to support the team through its vision and mission and values. And so once you know what the culture is that you want, and you know, you can workshop that and develop that with key people within the organization, then you need to communicate those clearly and often and hold people accountable for their performance. You know, there's a company in Australia called Atlassian. They're pretty well known these days since their IPO last year. You know, it started at $4.3 billion, I think it was, and now they're up around $5 or $6 billion in value. And I've been watching that company for 14 years since they were started by two young guys straight out of uni. And one of the things they did right from the beginning, which I really loved, and I actually got to meet them a couple of times and interview them, was they set clear values. And you know, really pragmatic and grounded values. Like, one of their values is don't screw with the customer. You know, and I always thought that was fantastic. But I saw a video of this company on their website, and they just had someone from the marketing team walking around the company with the camera. And they just stopped at random desks and they said, okay, tell us what you know of the company values. And everyone in the organization knew the values, knew the vision, knew the mission of the organization, was able to speak to it. And not only speak to it at a high level, but be able to say, and in my role that means this. And that's really successful culture. So what happens when you've achieved that, when you're able to communicate that clearly and have people take ownership of that, then you want to give them opportunities to shine, you know, provide the support, provide the recognition when they do good work. You know, a little recognition goes a long way, and not just when they're kicking a big goal, value their contribution for that, but also for all the milestones along the way. So provide training, provide recognition for good work. And, you know, we know from research that recognition is much more motivating, as you know, for people in the workspace than money. You know, there's a great book by Daniel Pink called Drive, The Surprising Truth About What Motivates Us. And he talks about the fact that money can actually be a demotivator or a disincentive if it's not provided consistently, whereas recognition is something that people will really warm to and really seek. And when it's provided in appropriate ways, it can be a fantastic motivator. And so when you have good people and they're being recognized and therefore they're performing because they want the recognition, and then you get a reputation for, you know, having great people and doing great work, and once you have that and have that strong culture, then it's easier to attract more great people because they want to work for you. And so it becomes this upward spiral of, you know, you're doing great work, you're kicking goals, you've got great people, you've got a fantastic culture that just reinforces that, you're holding people accountable, and then people line up to work for you. And Atlassian, for years now, whenever they've advertised a role, you know, 200 to 400 people would apply because they want to work for this company because they're known as having great values. They're known as being a wonderful place to work. And they give 1% of their profit to charity, and they encourage sustainability, and they always put their offices near public transport venues because they encourage their staff to you know, either cycle to work or catch the train or buses to work. So they really do walk the talk as an organization. And that just makes people value them and respect them and want to work for them. So a real success story and a great example of a company that's doing it right. So as a business growth strategist, you know, I love to collect those stories and hold those companies like that up as role models.
Again, some really sound tips for people out there. Now, let's do a bit of a shift, again, related to what we've been talking about. What makes for compelling speaking?
Oh, wow. There's so many things you could do here to make, you know, good speaking. And here's the thing, you know, firstly, I want to set the frame. Speaking is a privilege. When you speak from a stage, you're given a level of credibility from the people in the audience because you're up there and they're sitting in the audience. So, you know, any speaking opportunity, I think, you know, you need to take it really seriously and really respect that privilege first and foremost. A really good speaker will take the time to prepare well, and they will offer not only that, you know, relevant content and interesting content for their audience, but valuable content. They'll give away their knowledge when they're speaking, and they'll really try to serve their audience. And, you know, when I'm speaking, it's very much like, okay, I'll sit down and think about who's in the audience and what are their hopes and dreams and what are they here for? Why are they coming to hear me speak? And how can I serve them? And so that's the first thing for me is like, okay, what can I offer that's relevant to them, that's going to really enhance their lives, empower them, and give them valuable tips and tools that they can then go and use in their work and use in their personal lives and really make their lives better. And then you've got to deliver that content in a way that makes it really accessible to your audience. So telling stories and metaphors to bring the material to life, to make it memorable. You know, as a trainer, I use stories to ground concepts and messages I need to teach, because I know that when I tell a story, for example, I might tell a story about my daughter and some interaction I've had with her, and I'll do that from the stage. And I know that while I'm telling my story, the people in the audience, they're going into their own stories. They're going into their own personal stories of their interactions with their daughter, their son, their child, or if they don't have children, then they'll think about when they were a child and their interactions with their parents. So a story provides a structure for people to really look at their own lives and to get insights and learnings and personal wisdoms that provide a structure for personal insight. So that's really powerful. And because, you know, I'm a coach and I'll use any opportunity to help people grow and learn and develop, and self-awareness is key to that. So I'll use stories to develop self-awareness. And other techniques that are specific to speaking, such as, you know, spatial anchoring, using different parts of the stage to highlight, you know, positive things and negative things, and you know, they'll have part of the stage where I talk about growth areas and I'll stand in a particular part. And that just reinforces those concepts at an unconscious level. Now, really good speakers will use a lot of unconscious anchoring. They'll work through different modalities such as, you know, the visual, the auditory, the kinesthetic modalities that people use to process the world. A good speaker will use different techniques and different words and phrases from each modality to ensure that they're bringing along with them people from each of the modalities. You know, if you're just talking to the visuals, the kinesthetic people who work much through feelings and touch, you know, they'll get left behind. A good speaker will gather everybody in and take them on the journey. You have to keep the level of engagement high in speaking so that the learning happens. So using interaction, asking questions, using activities, getting people to write things down, to share with the person sitting next to them, all that will enhance the learning, the understanding, and the retention, the depth of retention that people get out of any talk that you give. And, of course, the level of energy that a speaker brings is key to their effectiveness. And one of the things I'll do, first, I kind of have a bit of a structure that I use in a presentation. So one of the first things I'll do is to do what's called the earn the right. And that's where I establish my credibility as a speaker with the audience. I need to tell them a little bit about myself. I need to give them an insight into me personally, who I am and what drives and motivates me, so they feel like they know me a bit on a personal level. And I also need to establish my credibility in terms of, well, do I know what I'm talking about? And can they trust what I say? Do I actually have the experience and expertise in this area that means I'm worth listening to? And so I'll weave that into the first 5 or 10 minutes of any speech I give, to ensure that I establish that credibility, and they can relax around, okay, you know, yeah, she knows what she's talking about and she's got something for me. Not that I want people to relax completely. You know, Tony Robbins talks about getting into your common sense corner and really questioning anything that someone says from the stage, because there is that halo around the speaker. You want to make sure, does this work for me? Does that resonate with me? Do I actually think that's going to work for my life? And, you know, if a speaker says something that you go, oh, I'm not so sure about that, great, question it, or ask a question of the speaker, or do your own research later, and really make sure that you're taking on board the things that you want to take on board and not being overly influenced just because someone's up on the stage. Of course, using visual aids, but not relying on them, is really important. So using, you know, not death by PowerPoint, but PowerPoint is a wonderful product. But if I'm presenting to an audience, I'll use PowerPoint, or often I'll use flip chart and I'll draw pictures as I go, particularly in a small group. If it's a large group, then yes, I'll use PowerPoint. But most of my slides are actually images and pictures to reinforce the concepts that I'm speaking about, rather than lots and lots of words on the slide. Although recently I was presenting in Korea for a meeting, and I got some wonderful feedback before I presented, fortunately, from some of my colleagues who were more experienced in multilingual audiences, and they advised me that, you know, when you're dealing with people who maybe don't have English as a first language, have English as a second or third language, then using words is more useful then, because it gives them the visual reinforcement of the message, because they may not necessarily get it first time from the speaker, but if they can also see it on the screen, that also helps to reinforce the message and helps them to process. So that was a great insight for me, and something that I'll use going forward when I'm speaking, particularly to audiences of mixed cultures.
You know, it's kind of fascinating. You know, you're talking about sort of integrating some credibility elements when you first start to speak. Let's say you're invited to a TED conference or something like that, or the World Economic Forum.
I dream of that, Stephen.
So the venue itself and having the invitation indicates that, you know, you're somebody that people should listen to. Do you still need to integrate some of those elements?
You need to connect the audience to yourself, yes. It's a very important part of that process of connection. You know, we live in a world where we're you know, part of our core drivers as people, you know, our key needs. And Tony Robbins did a TED Talk on this, you know, what drives us, and connection is part of it. And so, yes, I would do. I may not spend as much time at that sort of place where the credibility is established. It's not just about the credibility. It's also about the connection and building that bridge to each person so they feel connected to me. And I also do, as part of my process, connections across the room. So I'll ask questions, who's here for this and who's here for that? And throughout a presentation, I'll actually ask, you know, how many people in the audience, you know, work in these roles, or how many work in these roles? Because I'm actually wanting to create connections across the audience as well to help create that connectedness so that people actually learn better when they feel connected and they're able to engage more effectively when they feel connected.
I guess it's somewhat related in a sense in that it's about exchanging information in some sense, and especially maybe unidirectional information. But how could an enterprise excel at corporate communications?
Yeah, great question, Stephen. So as in anything that an organization does, you start with a strategy. You know, be clear about your vision, your purpose, your mission, and your values. And everything you communicate has to support that and be consistent with that. You need to understand your audience. You know, when I was in journalism school way back in the 80s, you know, they taught us that understand your audience, know who you're talking to, and then tailor your message accordingly. So you'll have different messages for your customers, for your staff, for your stakeholders, for government decision makers that you want to influence. And you'll have to tailor your messages accordingly. But regardless of the audience, your messages should be consistent across the different mediums. They may be tweaked, but they'll be consistent. You won't be saying, you know, substantially differently things to the different groups. You'll just position it differently and appropriately. So who is your audience? What do they want? What are their hopes and dreams? What are their values? And then develop and deliver your communications in the way that will most effectively impact that group. So, you know, traditionally we used newsletters and worked through the media. These days we have social media as well. So there's a whole range of tools that you can use to connect with your audiences, whether they be customers or clients or staff, and you'll use the different vehicles appropriately for the different groups. So for some groups, you know, you might focus on social media platforms like LinkedIn or Instagram or Facebook if you're focusing on consumers, particularly your Twitter. Today the focus is on engagement. We've gone beyond just sort of drip-feeding information out to our audience, expecting them just to take our static information and accept it. Now, it's very much a two-way street in terms of how organizations and corporations communicate. And you're trying to encourage engagement. So we want feedback. We want comments. It's a two-way conversation because the more people engage, the more time they spend engaging with your brand, the more they care about your brand, the more loyalty they have to your brand. And, you know, it's always been the case that it's much more powerful to have someone else talk about your brand than have you talk about it. Let's be honest. You can talk about your brand till the cows come home, but still, as everyone knows, that's marketing, that's advertising, that's great. But to have your customers go, oh, yeah, I really love this brand, I really love this service, you know, that's powerful because they're not being paid for it, and we know that. So there's a lot more credibility, a lot more value attached to what a customer says than what the company itself says. So it's a two-way conversation. But basic rules will still apply, such as, you know, largely keeping it positive, being responsive to feedback, and moving quickly to address any issues that arise. You know, there's been lots of examples of companies being burned because they refused to engage when there were issues that arose. You know, I remember Dell had some real serious issues several years back because there was negative feedback in the blogosphere and in the social media spaces, and they didn't handle it well. But if as a company, you know, don't be afraid of criticism, but listen to it. Welcome any opportunity for improvement. People love to complain. And if an organization lets them down, they will complain and they will complain loudly. But if that organization then listens to their concerns and moves to correct the problem, they'll become what we call a raving fan. And as a raving fan, I will tell everybody, oh, this company, they drove me crazy. But then they fixed it and they made me happy. And now I'm really committed. I'm really happy with them now. And they'll talk much more about that and their experience when a company turns things around for them than they will actually just complain. Another rule of thumb in communication, and some companies run foul with this one as well, is always tell the truth. Don't lie to your customers. Don't screw with the truth. That's dangerous. You might not tell all the truth because, you know, you're constrained by reporting issues or other things, other boundaries. But never lie to your customers or your stakeholders. You will get found out eventually and you will lose credibility and you will lose their trust. And when you lose a customer's trust or a stakeholder's trust, it's very hard to get it back.
I guess somewhat related to this then is what makes for excellent public relations. And I know this is a big specialty of yours as well.
Sure, it's an area I've spent, you know, 30 plus years of my life. Public relations is about using communication for influence. So whether it's to sell a product or promote an idea or an initiative or an event, you're trying to influence the audience to agree with your point of view and perhaps to take action. So, you know, while I did a lot of work in the product area of technology in the past, I really don't play in that space anymore. These days I work in the more intangible space of promoting ideas and concepts and professional associations like the ACS and the Australian Computer Society here in Australia and IFBIT, the International Federation for Information Processing, the Global Professional Association. So we're not selling products now but ideas and values. And so as a coach, I understand the principles of influence and the need to work through people's values when seeking to influence them. And so I can bring my training in that space in to influence how I work. And public relations, of course, largely involves working with journalists and media outlets, and that includes social media these days, to maximise opportunities for publicity through press releases, interviews, thought leadership columns, blogs and more. These days, of course, you know, social media is really useful, so we're spreading the message across a range of platforms. But as in, you know, the straight communications that we talked about before, consistency of messaging is key. You want to communicate with a similar tone and the same ideas across each platform. And, of course, in public relations particularly, you have to be responsive. So you might get a journalist ring up and I want to talk to your spokesperson or your CEO or chief about this issue. And you might only have 15 minutes to respond, particularly if it's radio or television. So responsiveness is key to make the most of every opportunity. But also it's very important to manage that pressure. So when I'm doing media training for my clients, it's very much like, so build in some space. Create some time for yourself. If you've only got 10 minutes, like, yes, it looks like, and I'll always say, like, yep, I'm in the middle of something, I'll call you back in 5. And give yourself 5 minutes as the client to get your thoughts together. You know, what are your key messages? What are your must-says, which is just a term that means what are the core messages that you want to get across in any interview situation because they're core to your brand values. And so have that preparation time. And public relations is very much about planning so that you can take advantage of these opportunities. So these messages are usually developed well ahead in advance. And it's just a matter of refreshing yourself about, you know, what are the things I was going to say here and what are the questions that the journalist might ask that I could start with and then take them to my core messages, because a good interview will provide 4 to 6 opportunities where a journalist will ask a question, you go, great, let me answer that, and then I'll take it where I want to go. And so, yes, you've got to answer the journalist's question, otherwise it's not useful for them, and it's got to be useful for them. And then you can take that question and weave into it some of your core messaging, some of your key branding, or some of your key influence principles to influence your audience through that answer. And so, you know, to provide that certainty, and public relations is very much about having those relationships with key journalists and key media outlets and building those through being, you know, responsive, available, reliable. So, you know, if you say you're going to call them back, you've got to call them back. If they call you, you've got to call them back. Because if you don't call them back or if you leave them hanging, they'll go find someone else. They don't have time to sit around. Journalists are very time poor. And so it's recognising that and helping them. You know, they've got to fill their column inches or they've got to fill their certain number of minutes in their news bulletin or in their documentary or in their current affairs program. And so my job is to provide them with valuable, useful content, relevant content, whether it's my client or whether it's just written material, so that they can use it and then, you know, want to come back to my client for more answers in the future. So, you know, it's a win-win. They need to get what they want, and I'm taking the opportunity, or my client is taking the opportunity, to get across our key messages so that we can influence the community or whatever audience we're trying to reach through that media publication.
You know, fundamentally core to a lot of this is effective writing, and you know, you have a background in public relations and corporate communications and You've been a journalist from a training aspect, an educational sort of orientation, and then, as you indicated, you work with this UN UNESCO-funded organization called the International Federation for Information Processing, which is global and consists of the national and international societies that are typically official in countries like the ACM in the US or KIPPS in Canada or the ACS, that is Australian Computer Society in Australia, and so on. And but a part of all of that work is you do a lot of writing. So what makes for effective writing?
Yeah, fabulous. Thank you for asking that one, because I'm really passionate about effective writing, and it is a lot of what I do, whether it's press releases or thought leadership columns. You know, for the last literally 20 years, I've been writing a column in the Australian newspaper, and once I get off the phone from this interview, I have to go and finish my next column for the president of the ACS, the Australian Computer Society. So I've worked with every president, you know, over the last 20 years in developing, you know, those thought leadership pieces to position the ACS as the credible source of information for the ICT profession in Australia. And so writing is key. And I guess it's my background in radio, which was my first job, you know, trained as a journalist, yes, and then my first two jobs were as a journalist and newsreader on radio. And when you're working in radio, you know that your audience is driving in the car or walking along the street or working with the radio in the background. And they may tune in to the news bulletin, but you get one chance to get their attention, you know, and you're reading the story. And they hear it, and they don't get a chance. It's not like reading a book. If they miss it, it's gone. They can't go back and reread the paragraph. So your communication must be really clear. And so clear, simple language that the reader can understand in one go is just critical. And, you know, you have to get it right the first time, and they have to get it the first time. So my rule of thumb whenever I'm writing something is to read it aloud. And go, does it make sense on first pass? Because if it doesn't, I'll rewrite it. I always use active language and make it as compelling and interesting and easy to understand as I can. Because if I don't feel like they've, you know, got every opportunity to understand it, then I feel like I failed in some way as a communicator. Now, I was reading an article yesterday while preparing for this column that I'm writing, and it was an academic research piece. And honestly, I kept getting lost in the words. It was verbose. It was wordy, and it was written in what I call academic speak, which is often passive language, and uses far more words than I would choose to use as a business writer. And that's a particular style, and that works for some contexts, perhaps. I really struggle with it, and I think most people struggle with it, because it's just hard to comprehend. So I'm all about making writing easy to comprehend, because the reality is communication is a two-way street. It's not just about what I say or what I write. It's about what the audience or the reader understands. Communication is what comes back. So when I'm working as a coach, just to change hats very briefly, you know, I may spend a bit of time teaching a client a tool or a piece of information that's really important for them, but then I'll stop at a point and I'll go, okay, tell me what you're getting. What do you understand from what I've just said? Because I need to make sure how it's landed. I need to understand what they've got from that, so that if there are any gaps in their understanding, I can address those. Because there's no point in me talking at them or just, you know, teaching them something unless I ground it for them and make sure it's relevant to their context and that they understand how to use it. So then we'll go, you know, okay, what are you going to do with that? So I've got to make sure that the communication is effective. Always check in and ask, what are you getting? So other rules of thumb as a writer, use fewer words rather than less. You know, if you're having to read 40 and 50 word sentences, that's just hard to process. You know, 20 to 30 words maximum for a sentence, and shorter if you can, because we process short sentences more easily. They're easier to understand, so communication happens more effectively. One of the things that's happening, you know, through the advent of the internet is people have shorter attention spans. So they don't want to read a big chunk of content. They want to read and absorb information quickly and productively. So use bullet points, use subheadings, highlight key phrases or quotes. People want to capture information quickly, and so laying it out on the page, how you do that, how you use subheadings to sort of highlight areas of interest and allow them to scan and then dip, which is more how people read these days. They won't necessarily read every word of an article. They'll scan and dip in the areas that are of interest to them. So I want to support that process. And so communicate in short chunks, keep your language succinct and to the point, and use, as in presenting, use stories, use metaphors to bring the material alive and to ground it for them and give them opportunities to really, you know, consider how it might be relevant in their lives. Because again, when I tell a story, they go into their story. And that's when the content becomes relevant to them personally. And that's really important as a part of communication.
You work with a lot of executives worldwide, and you've worked as a coach and in communications and different aspects of businesses and industry and media and so on. So you've had a lot of experience working with some really excellent people around the world. So what makes a great executive?
Wow, that's such a big question, Stephen. What's a great executive? I'm going to delete executive and say leader because I work with leaders. And whether they're executives or business owners or whether they're leading, you know, the professional associations that I work with. You know, great leaders are constantly developing other leaders. They're bringing people up through the organization. They're not trying to do it all themselves, but they're empowering others and they're challenging their people to grow and develop and achieve their potential. Great leaders will provide support, they'll provide recognition, they will appreciate their people. And so, and they will, you know, make sure that their people feel appreciated, feel supported. That's so important to a person really being able to give at their highest level, is that sense of, I feel supported, I feel respected, and I'm working with a leader that I respect because they appreciate me and they provide me with the recognition that is fair and that I need. Great leaders are predictable. By that, I don't mean they'll always do the same thing over and over again, although in some contexts they will. I mean they're consistent and they're reliable. They communicate with a level of authenticity and transparency, so you always know where you stand with them. They don't leave you in the dark. They make sure you know what's expected. So great leaders will set the expectations, and they will, you know, be clear that it's their job to communicate the vision and to keep directing everything that happens within the organization to the vision of the organization and the mission of the organization and goals and values of the organization. They should be the starting point and the filter, in fact, for everything that the organization does. And because great leaders will constantly talk those up and redirect people's attention to those, and that creates a real common sense of purpose within an organization. You show me any organization that's highly political, where there's a lot of gossiping and infighting and backbiting, I'll tell you an organization that's lost its vision, or where the leader is not constantly communicating and articulating the vision and people have forgotten what they're standing for, they've forgotten what they're about, and they've lost that common sense of purpose. And great leaders will absolutely drive that, and they will be the vision bearer of the organization and hold and fly that flag really strongly. You know, they operate with integrity. They do what they say they'll do. They walk their talk. And that's another way that they're predictable, because they own their role and they take responsibility for what they have to do, and they model excellence in that area for everyone in the organization. So, you know, the tone of an organization and the way that an organization operates starts from the leadership and flows down. It doesn't flow up. It flows down. And so the leader of the organization must set the tone for that and must be the role model for that. And they see clearly where the organization is going. They're able to inspire others with their vision, their strategy, and bring them along on the journey. They're also, you know, great leaders are excellent communicators. They're able to adapt their communication style for different audiences so that they can really connect in the right way with the different groups, the stakeholders, the clients and customers, the staff. You know, they'll adapt their communication style appropriately for that, so that they can have the biggest impact and communicate most effectively. And they'll have strong interpersonal skills, and they'll have great self-awareness, because self-awareness drives understanding and it drives behaviour. And, you know, if you've got a leader who's just not aware of the impact of their behaviour, then they're not necessarily going to be able to reflect on what's happening. They don't understand where they're having a negative impact. And the other thing is great leaders will be welcome feedback. You know, they'll want people to hold them accountable. They'll want people to say, you know, actually, I'm not sure that what you're doing here is consistent with the vision that you've set for the organization. Can we talk about that? And so they'll be open to those conversations, because nobody's perfect. We're all on a journey. We're all growing. And we all need to be open to that feedback and that commentary around, you know, appropriately around, well, have you thought about doing it this way? Or could we maybe do it another way that's better? Well, we can improve, because great organizations and great leaders are constantly looking to improve what they're doing and how they're doing it.
Well, Carolyn, I really appreciate you going over some of these major areas and sharing your tips through a series of questions. We're going to change direction now. And in this question, we're going to do that by talking about computing and, you know, should be a recognized profession on par with accounting or law and some of the others. And mm-hmm. with properties like demonstrated professional development, adherence to a code of ethics, personal responsibility, and you talked about responsibility and accountability. So public accountability, quality assurance, and recognized credentials. So I'm going to wrap up that question with a bunch of others. So I'd like to get your view of computing as a profession. And then on top of that, if you have any other sort of thoughts about professionalism and any recommendations in that area. And then on top of that, how about ethics and your recommendations? So really three parts. Should be a recognized profession. What is professionalism? Can you talk about that, your recommendations in that area? And then the ethical parts of professionalism, and what are your recommendations?
Yeah, great. Thanks, Stephen. Because, you know, having worked in the technology industry since 1987, which is when I first joined the IT sector, I'm passionate about this industry. I love it. It's so dynamic. It's so exciting. And it is pervasive, you know, like since 1987 to today, technology has taken over the world. Literally, there are very few industries, or well, I don't think there are any industries, but there are very few jobs where technology is not absolutely fundamental to empowering what happens. You know, the infrastructure, the systems, the applications, the apps on our phones, everything we do through technology. So technology is critical to our performance, and we now rely on it. So should it be a profession? Well, you went through the hallmarks of professionalism, of what a profession has, that you have demonstrated professional development, that you have a code of ethics, a code of professional conduct, that you take responsibility and there is public accountability, that there are professional standards and that there are recognised credentials and a core body of knowledge. These are the hallmarks of a profession. And yes, absolutely, you know, where I live in Australia, the ICT profession has been recognised as a profession for over a decade. And that's because the Australian Computer Society has been a member of Professions Australia for more than a decade. And they, in order to be accepted into Professions Australia, they had to meet those hallmarks. They had to do things like provide insurance for their members for professional liability and indemnity. And they had to have, you know, the core body of knowledge, which of course they've had for many, many years, decades. But make sure that they ticked all those boxes. Because, you know, technology is so critical now. You know, if technology doesn't work, it costs millions or billions of dollars, depending on the industry, and often lives. If the guidance system on a plane malfunctions, the technology malfunctions, people will die. The plane will drop out of the sky, and people will die. So, you know, yes, there should be professional standards. There should be some accountability around how technology operates, how systems are designed, how they are implemented, the standards around that, the project management methodologies that are applied to that. This all needs to be managed in a proactive way and in a way that holds people working in that industry accountable. It's not that I want to constrain my colleagues who are ICT professionals, but it's like doctors and accountants and lawyers, they have standards and they are accountable for the quality of what they do. You wouldn't go to a backyard accountant to do your tax returns, to manage your business, you'd go to, in Australia, a CPA. And I do, personally, you know, have an excellent accountant. She's expensive and she's great. And I'm willing to pay for her expertise. And it's absolutely the same in the IT industry. You know, you have to pay for that guarantee of expertise, that guarantee of knowledge, of currency of knowledge, and of experience that you're going to get with certified ICT professionals, with real professionals who are very committed to operating at professional standards. Now, technology is so pervasive today, and that's only going to continue. So when I say that, you know, there are really no jobs that don't rely on technology at some level, you know, I was talking to, in fact, I was walking down the street the other day with a colleague, and we were going to a meeting, and he's like, oh, do you want a coffee? And I'm like, no, I don't drink coffee, but thanks, wondering what he was doing. And he says, well, anything else? So I'm like, oh, look, I'd love a green juice, but, you know, and he's like, great. Well, he opened an app on his phone, dialed into a cafe not far from where we were that he goes to regularly, and he ordered three coffees and a green juice, which is my preferred poison, and then just picked them up when we were near the office and took them into the meeting. And it's interesting. Not only is that, like, it's a cafe, but using technology in a clever way and now relying on that technology because it brings some customers. So, you know, that order that he puts in has to get through. And when he gets to the cafe, that has to be ready. And so the technology has to deliver. But not only that, the interesting thing about that for me was that he was willing to walk an extra 50 metres to the second cafe away from the office. So not the closest cafe, but the one that let him pre-order. That's where he went. It didn't take a lot of extra time, but it saved him a lot of time in terms of waiting for the coffees to be prepared because they were ready when he arrived. And that's an example of something mundane like a cafe using technology as competitive advantage and actually winning business from, you know, the incumbent. So that's only going to happen more. All sorts of businesses, all sorts of organisations are going to more and more conduct their transactions, their business, their customer relationship management on technology. It has to be on. It has to perform. So having professional standards, staying up to date, operating in line with a code of professional conduct and practice, being part of a community of practice and having those defined levels of knowledge, they're all absolutely critical to maintaining those professional standards. And then you asked about ethics, Stephen. And yes, absolutely, ethics are important because, you know, bodies like the Australian Computer Society, TIPS in Canada, the ACM, the IEEE, IFERP as the global body, you know, they have a role to play as the guardian of the user community, you know, as in they are the voice of the ICT profession to kind of go, to hold them accountable and go, are you operating with the interests of the users in mind? And that's got to be first and foremost because, as I said, you know, when technology doesn't work or when it works nefariously or badly, and as in hacking and security breaches and privacy invasions, the cost of that is significant. And so there needs to be a watchdog. There needs to be an organisation like the ACS or IFERP or KITS and IEEE and ACM that absolutely hold that role and go, is this serving the public good? Because if it isn't, then that needs to change. Because, you know, individual consumers or even organisations don't have the global force, you know, to actually maintain that position. But these professional associations, they can be the voice of the profession and the voice of the consumers in that instance to make sure that technology is done in a trustworthy way. Now, we rely on technology. We trust it to work. Technology needs to be trustworthy. And that means the people who work with it need to be trustworthy. They need to operate according to a code of ethics and make sure that technology is applied in a way that will benefit users and not harm or disadvantage them. And having that accountability is really important. And making sure that, you know, there's a lot of discussion in the blogosphere and in the public domain about inroads into privacy. I was at a conference on the weekend and the speaker from the stage talked about the fact that when you put apps on your phone, nobody reads the terms and conditions. Who's got time? And they're so complex and so convoluted that, you know, we just tick the box and go, yes, okay, I accept the terms and conditions, but we don't read them, unfortunately. And sometimes those terms and conditions mean that we are giving permission for apps to access functions on our phone that we might not otherwise choose. And so, yeah, okay, they might need that in some context in order to function well, but the fact that we've given permission means that they could actually choose to take advantage of that. And so we need our organisations to be ethical so that they don't take advantage of those permissions, but actually do make sure that, yes, we've given them permission to access our emails or know where we are in the world at any given time, but that should never be abused. And so that individual consumers and groups should be protected from abuses like that. So ethics are important.
Carolyn, you've got this incredible history of accomplishment in so many domains as a trainer and corporate coach and executive advisor and in public relations and corporate communications, and the list goes on and on and on. You've done so much over so many years, and you've built up an incredible legacy of expertise, and you've contributed to so many different kinds of organizations worldwide. So with that incredible history, you must have come across what would have been at the time almost impossible challenges that you were able to master. And in going through those impossible challenges that you were able to master, you must have derived some lessons that you can share with the audience. Can you talk more about that?
Sure. It's interesting. I thought about this one for a while, because like, impossible challenges, and I had a real issue with it because I'm like, I don't believe in impossible. And as a coach and as a trainer, I kind of go, but everything's possible. You just got to find the way. So I don't buy into the word impossible, I think, and you said almost impossible, so that's cool. I think it's about resourcefulness. You know, there's a saying in the training industry that the level of resourcefulness you bring will determine how quickly you solve the problem, not if, but how quickly. And so over the years, I've found some things that the average person would think were crazy. You know, I've walked on fire 10 times. I've eaten fire twice. I've broken through wooden boards 8 times. I've actually walked into an arrow with my neck twice and broken the arrow. And I don't put these up as being particularly special. They're unusual, perhaps. Some people would say impossible, and certainly the first time I walked on fire, I thought that was impossible. I went to this event with Tony Robbins, and it was kind of early in my personal development journey, and I didn't even know at the time. I just signed up because I just picked up a book of his, and my friend had said, oh, he's coming. I'm like, great, let's go. I didn't even know it was a firewalk seminar. And I'm sitting in the audience, and Tony starts to talk about the firewalk, and I'm thinking, oh, you're going to walk on fire for us. That's cool. I like to see that. And then as he talks more, it's like, what, you want me to walk on fire? No, I don't think so. You know, I'm sitting there just shaking my head going, I don't need to do that. And then he kept talking, and I'm like, and the firewalk is a metaphor, right, for the things that you think you can't do. And as he continued to talk and I continued to reflect on my story, I thought, actually, I do need to do this for me. I do need to challenge myself. I do need to see what's possible for me because I've been living small. And so I walked on the fire that night, and it was an exhilarating experience, and I've done it 9 times since. And now, you know, in my role as a senior leader in the Robbins organization, I help to take people across the fire, and that's, as a coach, that's just so rewarding, to see people break through their limitations and their barriers and discover what's really possible for them. So all those things I just mentioned about walking fire, eating fire, breaking arrows with my neck, they're just other things that I've done as part of my personal development journey to challenge myself, to, you know, break through my limitations, to use those things as metaphors for the things that are holding me back in my life, to empower myself to go, okay, it's not about whether I can, it's about, you know, being willing to back myself and find the solution and find the way through. And once I've, you know, done a firewalk on it or broken a board on it, it's like, okay, then I'm committed because I've already broken through the board, so there's got to be a solution and I'm committed to that. So that's all doing stuff, right? And for me, life is not just about what you do and what you achieve. It's about who you become in the process. So all those experiences, they've stretched me. They've grown me. They've challenged me and allowed me to operate at a different level and to think at a different level and therefore do things at a different level that I could have, you know, 20, 10 years ago. And obviously life is a journey and we're constantly growing. And I guess I'm the sort of person who puts myself in positions where I'm forced to grow fast because I really value growth. It's a very high value for me. And I really value contribution. The contribution I can make to the lives of my clients increases exponentially with the amount of growth that I do. So I'm constantly growing. You know, I'm not an IT professional, although I work with them. But IT professionals are committed to lifelong learning, and they have to be because technology is changing so fast. As a coach, as a trainer, I'm committed to lifelong learning because I know that as I learn, I grow, I expand. And that means I'm bigger as a person. I'm able to deal with bigger quality problems. And then I compare myself to, you know, people like Richard Branson, who I really look up to. He's, you know, become extraordinarily successful doing what he loves. And on a daily basis, he deals with a level of problems that is far, far greater than anything that I encounter. You know, he's got, you know, massive companies, and the sort of problems he gets, you know, in trying to keep those companies operating at a really optimal level. You know, a class above what I would experience on any day. But he's had to create that for himself. You know, he's dealt with the little problems and he's grown through them. And so he's created for himself a role where he gets to be really creative and have a lot of fun because he's an innovator, he's an entrepreneur, and he's a bit of a crazy guy, you know. And so he does crazy things. But along the way, he's grown incredibly as a person. And I totally respect what he's done with his elders council. You know, he brought together people like Nelson Mandela, Bishop Desmond Tutu, Kofi Annan, Jimmy Carter, an extraordinary group of people who are focused on healing the world's big problems. Now, Richard Branson 30 years ago or 20 years ago, you know, wouldn't have done that. Dr. Richard Branson now, the man who's grown through dealing with those challenges on a daily basis, has made him someone who's committed to contributing at a very, very high level, at a global level. And so he's brought together the Elders Council to enable that. And that's an extraordinary group of people doing extraordinary things. So the sort of challenges that I deal with, the things that, you know, might be my impossibles, I deal with people. And while people are pretty predictable, they're also extremely challenging. My work really revolves around helping my clients to solve their impossible challenges. So, you know, I take them on because it's like, okay, well, this is what we're dealing with. And so whether that be, totally restructuring their organisation or their leadership team to make it operate more effectively, or resolving challenging issues with their professional and personal relationships, or overcoming negative financial results and refocusing the organisation to turn things around. And they're the sort of challenges that I take on a daily basis with my clients. And my job is not to fix it for them. My job is to empower them to fix it themselves, to find their own innate wisdom, and to, because, I don't know their businesses to the degree that they are. And frankly, as the coach or the trainer, I don't need to. That's not my job. My job is to be the sounding board, to be the mirror, to be the challenger, and to hold them accountable. I say to my clients, I'm your most unreasonable friend, because I'll love you and I will challenge you and I will hold your feet to the fire until you do what you said you do. And that's my job as the coach. So, the biggest challenges in my life are really the personal ones. The fact that I went through a marriage breakdown and how I contributed to that. Raising my daughter for most of her life as a single working mother and having to juggle my work challenges, my professional challenges, and being there for my daughter. Her challenges, watching her grow through anorexia and bulimia and then being diagnosed with diabetes while she was in the clinic with anorexia, going through acute depression and a suicidal phase, and growing through all that to the point where she's now 23 and she's an extraordinary young woman, and she's going after her hopes and dreams. She's really going for it now in her life. And I'm excited to see what she does in her life and what she achieves. But I'm more excited about who she's becoming along the way. And she's just a wonderful young woman who is nurturing her talents and skills, and she wants to create a career in performing, and she will. That's her journey, and my job is to be her mum and her cheer squad and to just support her through that process. And along the way, there's been major financial setbacks and the death of my father years ago. And this is just the stuff of life. Everyone deals with this. No one escapes life's challenges. And I guess you said, what are the lessons that I've learned from my impossibles? We have a choice. We have a choice in how we deal with life and how we respond to life. And I talked earlier about working with executive teams and taking a position of responsibility and of ownership. And that's my choice as an individual in my life. I can play the victim and go, this stuff's happening to me and I have no control, and give up my power. And that's being a victim. And the thing is that when I play the victim, I can't actually change my circumstance. I can only change what I own. If someone's an alcoholic, the first thing that they do at meetings for AA, for Alcoholics Anonymous, is they get them to own their position. They get them to say, okay, I'm an alcoholic and this is what I'm working on. And it's not about reinforcing their identity, but it's about actually owning where you're at and then being able to move beyond it because you own it. You can't change what you can't own. And so I have to own the good and the bad in my life, and then I can work through it and I can move forward. And recognizing that I have a choice, how I deal with things, it's inevitable that we'll meet with challenges and problems. But, rather than let life beat up on me and giving in and playing the victim, I choose to live powerfully. I choose to live authentically. And it doesn't always work first time. And the thing for me as my coach, as a coach myself, I'm there for my clients, and I have coaches who are there for me, because when I'm in a challenge, it's like with anybody else. I'm in the bag, and I can only see the constraints of the bag. And so I need another coach to kind of challenge my thinking and challenge my assumptions and the limitations I'm putting on myself, because I'm being unresourceful in that moment. And I have some great coaches who are in my life that I can call at a moment's notice and go, I need some time. Can you spend 10 minutes? And they'll poke the hole in the bag, or show me how to poke the hole in the bag of my problem and see through, to get that different perspective, to take back my power that I've given up to the problem, take back my power and go, okay, well, what is the first thing I need to do to start working on this problem, to take responsibility and to start moving towards resolution? And it's one step at a time, but those steps really matter. And it's making that choice to live authentically. Now, I was reflecting on authenticity while I was in this course on the weekend. Personally, I think authenticity is one of the most attractive traits or qualities that we can see in another person. When someone is being truly authentic, really owning who they are and being willing to express who they are from that position of total authenticity, that's just compelling. We are drawn to that. And YouTube will give us huge examples of people being authentic, not always at their best. Unfortunately, YouTube tends to attract a wide range of behavior. There's some really good ones, but there's some really bad ones as well. But it's compelling, And so even people who are just operating at the lowest common denominator of humanity will attract big audiences because it's compelling to see a person being completely authentic and completely expressing. But when we're authentically powerful and we're choosing to come from a place of ownership and responsibility and to really be, you know, a person who takes action and a person of influence and a person of integrity, as in I do what I say I'll do, that's compelling. And that's what, you know, those sorts of people, they get to step up and be leaders because people will follow you. People will absolutely follow someone who's authentic and you can create a body of influence and do something really meaningful, really make a massive contribution to the world. And I think, you know, we all have a contribution to make. I don't think any of us are here by accident. And as a coach, you know, I fundamentally believe that everyone is extraordinary and everyone is good. And there's stuff that we do. And some of that's good and some of that's not so good. But that's not who we are. We are good and we have enormous potential. And it's a choice to step into that and to act from that as leaders that will dictate the level of contribution we make in the world.
You've shared so many different insights with us, and I thank you for doing that, you know, based on so much experience and working across diverse communities, but also facing many challenges yourself in your personal life. And I guess that's the authentic part as well that you've been sharing during this interview. You know, you have many interests. Do you wish to talk about any of them at all?
There are, you know, as a coach and as a leadership trainer, I encourage my clients to have balance in their lives. And, of course, I have to lead by example. So I'm all about having balance in my life. So, yes, there are lots of other things that I do outside my work. You know, I'm very committed to health and fitness. So I work out 4 to 5 times a week and, you know, go to the gym and spend a lot of time just keeping my body healthy. And I'm a real movie buff. I love to read. I guess the other aspect of my life that hasn't come into it is, you know, I used to be a musician. And, in fact, I almost became a professional musician. So in my late teens and early 20s and all through school, I played in orchestras and my instrument was the French horn. And, you know, it was something that my father in particular really fostered. He was a frustrated singer, loved opera, loved music, and the house always had music playing if my dad was at home. Regardless of whether he was down the bottom of the garden or not, the music was blaring through the house. So I grew up with a real love of classical music. And it was my music initially that took me traveling around the world. I went to New Zealand, to Japan, to China, to Hong Kong as part of the Queensland Youth Orchestra. And, you know, had wonderful opportunities to play concerts in different cities through China and Japan and New Zealand and Hong Kong and to share that gift. And it was almost an arbitrary decision, but the right decision, I think, not to become a professional musician because I thought quite carefully about it at the time and decided, no, that's not for me. And it was bizarre, really, because then when I moved from Brisbane to Sydney, which is, you know, 1,000 miles away, I actually gave up music for a long period of my life and then came back to it later, not as a musician. These days I sing, which I love to do, but in terms of just enjoying music, going to concerts more, because I went through a period when I first moved to Sydney where I just didn't make that a priority, which is a weird decision considering it had been such a big part of my life previously. And that was a bit of a lesson when I came back to it, how important it was and how much I'd missed it. And so, you know, I guess the lesson for me from that was to really be true to the things that make my heart sing and to provide opportunities in my life for the things that fill me up. Because when I'm filled up, whether it be by spending time in nature, I love being in the sun, not to the degree that I get sunburn or anything, but I love the sun. I love being out in nature, being in gardens, walking in the sunshine, hearing birds, seeing those things make me happy. And so when I'm happy, I can function better. I can serve people more effectively and my contribution is greater. So I believe I have a responsibility to kind of keep my tank full by doing the things that empower me and uplift me, because then I am more able to bring my contribution to the world and to serve my clients and colleagues more effectively. So, yeah, lots of interests, and they're important because they help me do what I do better.
We're going to broaden sort of the questions here in the sense that you choose the topic here. Do you see any broader challenges that are facing us today and you want to talk about? Maybe even some solutions that you can propose?
Solutions. Yeah, interesting. I mean, there are obvious challenges. There's been that whole debate about climate change, you know, firstly whether it's real and then secondly, how do we deal with it? And there are things like climate change that I kind of go, yeah, that's an issue, and I do what I can do as an individual, but I'm not going to invest time in being worried about it or being concerned about it because, A, I don't have the skills or the knowledge to fix it, and, B, I have enormous faith in humanity, and I absolutely believe that that will get fixed by technologists. I absolutely believe it'll be ICT professionals who are ingenious and creative and innovative who will apply technology to address things like climate change. They'll find a solution. I have no idea what it'll be, but that's not my space. The things I worry about and that concern me are people issues. And, you know, when people are inhumane to other people, I struggle with that. So I look at ISIS, for example, and you get, it's a group of people who are operating at a very low level of consciousness, as consciousness frameworks go, very driven by significance and a need for control and a need to be right. And they just want to control the whole world around them and make everyone conform to them. And they're doing things that are just inhumane. And remember, I come from a perspective where everyone is extraordinary. So I just look at that and it makes me sad because I go, these are people who, some of them have been manipulated or trapped through emotional manipulation or their need for recognition that hasn't been met in other areas of their life, so that, you know, they've been subverted and manipulated into these sorts of environments because their need for significance and acknowledgement is so great. And they mistakenly believe that it's going to be a path to enlightenment or righteousness. But reality, what we see is a group of people who have no respect for anyone other than themselves, complete intolerance, very lack of openness. And, you know, they are destroying historical sites. They are killing innocent civilians and using them as shields. And this is just inhumane behavior. And I, you know, I struggle with how do we resolve those kind of issues? And I don't have the answer. If they were in front of me, there are things I would do to try and understand them and break through with them and to reach them. You have to start with the leadership because it's very much a situation where people are being manipulated and controlled. And there, you know, there's very sophisticated methods of control going on there. So, you know, for me, it's like manipulation is something that I absolutely use in a training room. But my intent, you know, I have permission for my clients to manipulate them for their best interest, for their growth. And so for me, you know, manipulation in itself is not a bad thing. It's the intention, the agenda of the manipulator that matters, because the definition of manipulation is just to handle skillfully. So I handle skillfully in terms of showing them their negative behaviours so that then they can get insights and grow and then make choices about how they want to behave going forward. But here we have people who are being manipulated for negative outcomes, and they personally are having their humanity diminished through some of the things they're doing as part of ISIS, you know, chopping off the heads of innocent people. It's just ugly, ugly behaviour. It's inhumane behaviour, and it's not what they're worthy of. You know, they are human beings and therefore magnificent and with magnificent potential, but that potential is not going to be realised within that organisation, and that's a tragedy. So these are the kinds of issues that I follow, you know, the conflicts around the world and they're the things I worry about because I'm like, how do we bring people together to promote understanding and compassion and respect? I'm a great believer through my work, but through who I am as a person, that everyone deserves respect and other perspectives, should be considered and listened to. And if I did get down to sit down with ISIS, I would listen first before I spoke. Because unless you listen first, you don't get the opportunity to influence. Influence only happens when rapport has been created, when there's a connection. And so somehow we've got to find a way to make a connection with that group in a way that they can respect and then create some influence to move forward in those situations and in other conflict situations around the world. So I don't know if that completely answers your question, Stephen, but that's kind of where I'm at.
Carolyn, you've had this fantastic opportunity to travel and speak and work and influence and impact organizations and governments and media and industry and to work and engage with some of the top people in the world and some of the top leaders in the world. So from all of that opportunity, of engagement. Do you have any one or more stories that you can share? Maybe something that really surprised you, or you thought, oh, wow, that was incredibly interesting, or maybe something that was really amusing?
So what's coming up for me, because I didn't have a ready answer to this and I wanted to see what kind of came up. And I have worked with extraordinary people, and my philosophy as a lifelong learner is always to learn from the best. So I have traveled over a lot of my trips around the world have been very much to go and learn and sit at the feet of someone who I consider to be a master in the space, and to learn from them, so that I can then, do what I do better. Having worked with people like Tony Robbins, Steve Linder, who's my neurostrategy trainer and top five in the world for NLP and neurostrategy, just an extraordinary individual who comes from his heart. Tony Robbins, runs it's probably a multi-billion dollar business now, and works with presidents and elite sports people and, has influence. When Bill Clinton was called out for what he did while president, he called Tony Robbins. So that's his level of influence, much greater than mine, and that's why I go learn from him. But also, I guess the lesson and what I want to refer to here is that they're still just people. We're all just people. And so, yes, I get to see these people at their best, but I've also seen them make mistakes, and I've also seen them be fallible and make errors in judgment. And so I guess what I want to point to is that sense of no one has it completely sorted. We are all on a journey, and we can all learn from each other, and we all have a responsibility as part of humanity to contribute to that learning. And so my trainers I really look up to and respect, and they have taught me so much. But they have also taught me that anything they can do, I can do. And while I struggle to actually believe that sometimes, because I go, oh, that's Tony Robbins, and he's up there on the stage. But it's really what I'm really talking about is the incredible potential that everybody, every human person has. If we are willing to back ourselves and to really pursue our passions and to really step into the unknown and allow that extraordinary brain that we have, and I'm talking about the unconscious mind that is the 98-99% of our processing that just will back us 100%. It's like if I don't know consciously, that's okay, because my unconscious will provide what I need in the moment for me to bring the magic. And just to back ourselves and know that when we're present and we're authentic, and if we've done our preparation, then what we need will come. I believe life itself is a journey of growth, and that life conspires, whether, you can call it God, you can call it the universe, I don't mind what you call it. It's a personal thing, and I'm open to all perspectives on this. But life, or God, or whatever, conspires for your best interest, for your highest good. And I don't mean for your happiness, because your highest good is usually about growth. And growth, is as painful as we want to make it when we resist the learnings. But the learnings are always there, and the opportunities are always there. And so being willing to kind of reflect on what we do and to look at our lives, not from a point of judgment, but from an openness, and go, okay, well, what is happening right now in my life, and what meaning am I giving it, and what's the lesson here for me? How can I use this to actually grow as a person, to be able to perform at a higher level, or bring new insights, or make a bigger contribution? Because it's I said earlier on, it's who I become through the process of what I do that is the most important thing, and that's what I tell my clients. We think that when I do this, I'll have this, and then I can be happy. No, be happy now in whatever you're doing. Be focused now. Be passionate now. Be present now. Because now might be all that you have. No one is promised tomorrow. No one is guaranteed a future. I tell people I want to live to 150. I do, and I absolutely believe that that's possible for me. I think the technology is available now and coming, and that there are products and strategies and tools that we know about the body and how it operates, and supplements we can provide that allow us to live longer and to slow down and even reverse the aging process. And short of getting hit by a bus, I think I'm going to have a really long and fulfilling life. And so I approach my life as, well, if I've got that long, because that's what I like to choose, then what am I going to do with that? Because there's so much to do, and I can get really excited about the possibilities around that. And I might get hit by a bus tomorrow. I can't stop that. I can't control that. I'll be careful, obviously. But things happen. Life happens. And it's about making the most of right now and living with passion and conviction and authenticity right now, being in integrity. And as an IT professional, you know, if that's what it means, because I know that's going to be some of the audience and they're the people I work with, operating with ethics and having professional standards and being current or whatever it is you do, doing it to the best of your ability so that, you know, when I am gone, when you are gone, what's the legacy that we've left? What are people, how do people remember it? Was it that, she did that and she, or who she was and the contribution that she made? That's what I want people to remember. And that's what drives what I do.
Caroline, we're down to our last question, and this is where I turn the tables and I ask you, if you were conducting this interview, is there maybe one or two or three questions you would have asked, and then what would be your answers?
It's so tricky. You know, as a coach, I have lots of questions that I ask people all the time, and sometimes I'll do this, I'll turn the tables and go, what is it that, you know, you don't want to tell me that I need to know, or what is it that that if I knew it, I would move things in a different direction. For this, you know, I guess I've really made a choice here to not hold back, to share some of my personal journey and personal challenges. So I've tried to be really authentic. If I was to pick a question right now, it might be about the future. What do I want to accomplish or achieve, or where am I going right now? That's influencing what I do in the moment. You know, I just spent the weekend in a business growth seminar. And it's actually a seminar that I did 4 or 5 months ago as a participant. And as is the case, you know, it's a real trap for some of us who do a lot of personal development to actually then, you know, you go and learn something and then what do you do with it? Because that's the real test, right? Education is not about learning. Education is about creating change. And so I did this course back in August. So it was that long ago. It was August last year. And out of that, I kind of made a couple of promises to myself when I talk about living in integrity. And I didn't take all the actions that I needed to do to fulfill on those. And so I really challenged myself about that. And I was like, okay, well, how are you going to create leverage with yourself? And so what I did was put myself back in the environment. As a crew person, as a support person for that speaker and for the team to help run the event for other people. And not only did I do that, and this is not to, you know, make myself feel good or make myself look good, because I'm trying to reverse what I see as, you know, a failing in not taking the action initially. I made sure that I actually was completely authentic about why I was there. So when, you know, there was a guy from Infusionsoft, which is a software application that I have been paying for since August and not been using, and it's a business growth software, you know, it's like a CRM. And so I made sure I had the conversation with the guy from Infusionsoft in America about, you know, I haven't been doing what I said I do. And he was great. He was completely non-judgmental, but he said to me, which is what I wanted, so next time I see you, that'll be different, right? And I'm like, absolutely. So now I have leverage with him, I have leverage with myself, and I had conversations with other crew members and with the leadership about, you know, I'm partly here. I'm here to serve. I'm here to contribute. I'm here to support the journey of other people who are doing the seminar. And I'm here to force myself, put myself back in a situation where I have to take action, where it would be so embarrassing for me to show up again in that community, because I want to. I want to be part of that group running those courses. But it would be so embarrassing for me to show up a second time and be able, and say nothing's changed. So now I have lots of motivation to actually do the things that I didn't do this time around. So that's exciting for me, because, you know, I'm starting to do my job list for that thing, and not that it wasn't done the first time around, but and to take action in that space so that I'm really, as an entrepreneur, putting into place the things I need to do to be successful. You know, we know that digital disruption is changing the way business is operated, and digital transformation means that there are new opportunities for small business to operate, you know, on a global scale. So for me as an entrepreneur, not to take every advantage that is available to me is irresponsible and, you know, being a victim. And that's not consistent with who I say I am, and that's not an integrity position. So I wasn't going to say any of this, but this is me being authentic. And so, yeah, that's the question that you probably wouldn't have asked, but that's the one I've answered.
Well, Carolyn, it's been a great time with you. I mean, you've shared so much of your experiences, your insights, and your personal views, and it's, you know, it's just such great value to our audience, all the wisdom that you provided. So I just wanted to thank you for coming in today and just doing this interview and contributing so much in terms of what you're doing with the world and with the different societies, but also here sharing with our audience.
Oh, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you for the opportunity, Steve.
I'm Stephen Abraki, and this concludes our exclusive interview with Carolyn New. Carolyn is an international authority in coaching, training, communications, writing, public public relations, and marketing.